What is Maine? Who is Maine? What are the stories of those who have lived here from the beginning, that migrated here, and that continue to inhabit this unique place? These are Conversations from the Pointed Firs.
Welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. My guest today is Noel Rubinton, author, journalist, and editor, whose work has appeared in leading publications such as the New York Times, Newsday, and the Washington Post. His writing has spanned many fields, including government, politics, culture, transportation, and history. A graduate of Deerfield Academy and Brown University, he's been reading John McPhee's writing for many decades. He is a regular visitor to Maine. Noel, welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs.
Thank you.
We usually start with trying to figure out who you are. So can you give us a little bit of your history, where you come from, how you got there, what you've done, and how did you stumble over the work of John McPhee?
So I've been a journalist all my professional career, working for daily newspapers, mostly in and around New York, and also for nonprofit organizations. But I've also been a reader really all my life. And one of the most important authors I've ever read was John McPhee. When I was 14 years old, I was going to private school in New York City, where I was living, and I decided I wanted to go to school somewhere else. And somehow, when I was searching for a new school, my parents gave me the second book by John McPhee, The Headmaster, which is the story of the headmaster of Deerfield Academy, who held that job for 66 years and really transformed the school.
No, he not only transformed the school, but he was a institution in the private school world. I heard about him all the way out in St. Louis, Missouri.
Absolutely. And he was a major power in Western Massachusetts for much of his life. So I read that book in one sitting, and I decided on the spot that I was going to go to Deerfield Academy, which I did a couple of years later. But I also decided, I don't think I said it to myself at the time, that I was always going to follow John McPhee. So I've really read his books now for 55 years. I read virtually everything he'd written, or I thought I had read virtually everything he had written.
And you have not. I mean, give us some idea of the scope. I mean, there's a photograph of you with a pile of books by your side, all McPheeana, and it's almost as tall as you.
That's kind of the easy part. I mean, McPhee has written, depending on how you count it, about 35 books. And that, I thought, that and all the New Yorker articles that represented most of those books was it. But I ended up finding out in the last 4 years, as I've been working on this project, that there was a tremendous amount of more McPhee writing out there. And it became just a great, exciting detective hunt to find it.
And while you were working along, I mean, was this a parallel track, or did you come to this after you'd finished your sort of journalism career?
I've been looking to write a book for many years, and I'd had plenty of starts and stops, like a lot of other would-be authors. And one day, this idea just came to me to write about McPhee, to do kind of a combination of a biography and a guide about him. Because I'm just incredibly grateful for him for all the impact he's had on me as a writer and as a reader, and I know so many other people. And I wanted to see if I could bring his work even more to light to people who know his work or people who don't know it as well.
Well, if you, as a writer, it's an interesting form you've got here. It's scholarly in effect, it's an annotated bibliography where you go through sort of the list of everything he's ever written, and there's sort of comments about it in such and such a way. And when it's done in an academic way, it could not be maybe more tedious than anything counting ants. But this is readable. I mean, what is really interesting about it is the sort of your personality that sort of walks in step with McPhee along this long pathway. You started at the Appalachian Trail and we're getting close to Cacodden.
Well, I appreciate you getting the idea of my book. I mean, I started with him at age 7, where his earliest writings were, and have carried on to 94, where he's still writing. And I really wanted to try to show his process, but also show a lot of work that nobody has ever seen before of his.
What's the most obscure thing you found?
Well, I think the most obscure thing is a body of work, and that was for Time Magazine. because McPhee wrote for Time magazine for about 6 years in the late 1950s and early 1960s at a time when there were no bylines in Time magazine. So none of his work was credited. And by working through the archives of Time magazine and relying somewhat on John's incredible memory, I was able to document over 500 articles that he wrote for Time magazine. I included highlights in the book. And this really is new McPhee, because nobody has known. I mean, John knew it at the time when he wrote it, but nobody would know even the cover stories that he did about some of the biggest entertainments of our time, Barbara Streisand, Richard Burton, Joan Baez, that those were John McPhee's.
As though those 500 haven't been collected into a book. It's another book. He can do it when he's 96.
Could be. I think his cover stories especially would make for a great book. They're really fantastic.
Yeah. How'd you meet him?
So I contacted him through an intermediary to tell him my idea, to see if he was willing to cooperate. And he wrote right back to me and said he was extremely grateful for my idea and would be glad to cooperate. And I got together with him. This was back into the fall of 2021. And I've been together with him about a dozen times at his house and his academic office in Princeton, New Jersey.
So what was it like when you met him the first time face to face?
It was surreal. For somebody who I had read and thought about for so long, I never in my life thought that I would sit on his couch with him. But very quickly, it became easy in the sense that he is one of the most easy to be with people I've ever met. It shows in his work, because he makes such an incredible range of people comfortable in talking to him. And he just he's a great listener. And he really puts people at ease and makes them feel like they can say what really is on their minds.
It's really part of the interview thing is to know when to shut up, and but also to imply some kind of non-judgmental, welcoming sensibility that says it's okay. You can tell me your innermost, your darkest secret, and we're going to get to yours in a few minutes. But let's. Let's keep going here.
But that's very much his way. Yeah. The range of people he's talked to in his career is enormous, but I think he's been consistent.
Mm-hmm. When you got there, you found a man who basically became an institution at Princeton University. Thousands and thousands of students over a very long time with amazing amount of what, loyalty, gratitude? Is there a cult?
So I think this was one of the many parts of McPhee that I really didn't understand. I knew that he taught some course at Princeton, but I didn't know that he taught this writing seminar for 50 years and that he had 544 direct students, many others who he came in contact with. But those people, he had an incredible impact on. And they've gone on to do all sorts of things. Probably a disproportionate number of them have gone on to be writers, and they are incredibly loyal to him. He's still in touch with an enormous number of them, and all the time he's telling me about what this one or that one did, and not just the famous ones.
You're a journalist, and you've been in a situation where you're interviewing people, and you're observing them, and the story has two parts. It's what you see and what you find behind what you see. What did you get to that point where you suddenly had in your mind a kind of myth, you found the reality, now you're looking at the reality in a kind of adjusted myth? Is he a bigger man than you thought?
Yeah, I don't think I ever imagined how creative he is, how driven he is, and how controlling he is in terms of his writing. And I mean that in a positive way.
Right.
And he has an incredibly prolific, track record as a writer, but I don't think I really thought about how did he get there. And I learned a lot. He is a lot larger than when I met him.
Mm-hmm. And so how would you characterize his path to get there?
Just incredibly ambitious and determined. He is another person. He wanted to be a writer from really probably when he started to talk. And he has written his whole life. He's sacrificed a lot. I mean, the only other real hobby he has besides his family is fishing, but but fishing is figured into his writing. But it's just incredible that for about 10 or 15 years, he wrote a book a year. Wow. That's just incredible. Anybody who's even thought about writing a book would kind of blanch at that idea.
Well, and as you read through them as a writer, you're going to know how much research went into them. As a reader, maybe you're not fully aware, but these books are brilliantly researched.
Right. I mean, this is the literature of fact, in effect, which is what the course he taught was called for many years, where there are just millions of facts in every book, every article he writes are just filled with facts. And anyone who's done any sort of reporting understands what it is to accumulate those facts, to verify those facts, and to get them out there. It's astonishing, his research.
Well, let's come back to that literature of fact phrase, which I really like. What was the first book you read?
Well, it was The Headmaster. So it was a book about Frank Boynton.
Right. And then what happened after that? Did you just go topsy-turvy in order? What?
Well, I was reading them as it went along. So that book I read in 1969 or 1970, I read the book that he published in 1967. So I was reading his books pretty much in real time as they came out. I'm a lifelong subscriber to The New Yorker. My parents were subscribers. So I was reading his articles whenever they came out in The New Yorker. So when I did this book, I did a little catch up and filled in some gaps, but I've read everything pretty much in sequence.
Wow. And so let's just go back in terms of the beginnings. Where did he come from? And how do you think his sensibility was shaped from being a young man and on?
Well, he is really, he was born in Princeton. And he's lived probably 92 of his 94 years in Princeton, New Jersey. But that's probably not what you think of in terms of, you know, Maine or a natural wilderness area. But the big shift, I think, for him came when he was about 7 years old. His father was a doctor. He was the physician for all the Princeton University sports teams, among other things. But he also, in the summer, went to a camp called Keewaydin in Vermont. Mm-hmm. And so John McPhee started going to Keewaydin, and he ended up going there every summer through about age 21.
Wasn't there a connection between Deerfield and Keewaydin?
A connection in people, but probably not in organization. Mm-hmm. So that's where he really was introduced to the great outdoors. When he was 7 years old, and one of the first things he ever wrote, he wrote for his elementary school magazine, as it were. And these were one paragraph articles that he wrote. And one of the articles he wrote when he was 7 years old was How to Make a Canoe.
Well, Keewaydin was a canoeing camp.
Right.
Up in the Canadian wilderness. And as I recall, they went out for long expeditions, weeks at a time. And it was a kind of its own little outward bound experience.
But they also had a branch in Vermont, I think on Lake Dunsmore. Mm-hmm. And that's where John McPhee went. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if he went to the Canadian branch at all. I've heard other people talk about that branch. But he went to the one in Vermont, and he was there all summer. His mother ran the camp store. His father was the doctor. And that's where he really fell in love with the outdoors, which became, I think, the primary subject of his writing for his entire career.
So if you asked him, what does that mean, his response to the outdoors, how would you enumerate his answer? What do you think his answer would be?
Well, I think what he said many times is that his interests were pretty fully formed by the time he was 10 years old. And he's written about those interests for all his life. He's not a terribly introspective person. It's only been in recent years that he's actually started writing more about, the kind of the circumstances of his life. And I don't think he's ever really written about why it was that why nature and the earth and environmentalism and canoes, why that so excited him. It was kind of, like rinse and repeat. He did those things over and over again, and that became his life and his interest. And fishing was added to that.
I suspect geology had to be in there somewhere. A collector of rocks, mountainous environments.
So geology, he credits to a geology teacher at Deerfield Academy named Frank Conklin. and introducing him to the subject. But that kind of lay, you know, didn't take off for many years after that. And so his whole geology phase started in the, in the late 70s or early 80s, when he wanted to do a talk of the town piece for the New Yorker, which are the short pieces in the front of the magazine, about one cut of rocks just on the New Jersey side of the George Washington Bridge. So he was going to do like 500 words, and that turned into 20 years and four and five books. So it was something, it was obviously something in his head, and he was excited about it, but it wasn't something that he had planned for years and years.
Right. About a week ago, I was in a house with an old library in Maine, and on the shelf was Basin and Range. And I pulled it off the shelf, and I opened it up and tried to look through it. And I said to myself, this is incredible. This is a geology textbook. This is, but it reads like a flowing spring. It's an easy read, but it's a hard read at the same time, in the sense that it's so comprehensive and so detailed and so evocative. I was so impressed for the second time, because I did read the book maybe 30, 40 years ago. Some of these books sort of, they're generalities evinced by people. Some of them are profiles, and the generalities are revealed in the context of that particular individual. Can you give me some examples of those books?
Well, I think the profile books are, you know, certainly the headmaster, the Frank Boyden book is one. His John McPhee's first book, A Sense of Where You Are, is the same for Bill Bradley. Another example of that kind of book is, I think, one of the classic McPhee books, Encounters with the Archdruid, which is really a biography of David Brower, the great environmentalist. But McPhee takes him on three trips around the United States with, you know, kind of his opponents, people who were developers. So McPhee is a book about the ransom of Russian art, which is about a man who smuggles, you know, thousands of pieces of Soviet dissident art out of that. So McPhee likes to write stories through people. Even the geology books are driven by people, with the geologists who act as the guides, because they're not just books about rocks. They're books about the people who, you know, figured out geology and who are on the cutting edge of geology.
Right. If you were just joining us, this is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors, artists, and exemplars who evoke the spirit of Maine. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio 89.9 FM. Streaming online and archived at weru.org and available as podcast on pointedfirs.org. I'm your host, Peter Neal. I'm speaking today with Noel Rubinton regarding the extraordinary range of subject and insight of the author and New Yorker writer, John McPhee. The Brower book was a revelation for me as well. He was the founder, director of the Sierra Club, and ended in sort of a controversial situation. I think he was ousted because he was too radical.
Right.
He was a man who had high principles, driven against any kind of compromise, it would seem, and he really comes alive. And as a young aspiring environmentalist at the time, I asked myself, is this what it takes to actually succeed when you're up against the things that he was up against in terms of the well-funded developers with no sense of reference for nature?
I mean, it's interesting. As you described David Brower, in some ways you were describing John McPhee, because he has the same level of high principles and just incredible determination to go forward no matter what the obstacles.
There is a connection in one of those profile books with down east, with Maine, Andy Chase, the focus of Looking for a Ship. Talk about that one a little bit.
So that was an interesting example of where the person who ultimately was the subject of the book suggested the idea for the book. So Andy Chase you know, reached out to McPhee, and they had correspondence over time. And eventually McPhee said to himself, I'm sure, this is a story. And so they went out and went on a long cruise to South America as a way to take a look at the declining merchant marine. And Andy Chase, as some people listening might know, is somebody who's taught at Castine for a number of years, merchant marine, has retired from that and still lives in the area. And he and John McPhee have become, you know, close friends, as John McPhee has become of many of his subjects. But it's an incredibly vivid book telling the story. You learn so much about the merchant marine, about being out on the water, about the U.S. economy, about South America. I think that's the thing about McPhee is you learn so much. Yeah. He's covering so many subjects.
I agree. I didn't know Addie at the time, but he did stay in our apartment in New York once looking for a ship. I think he had to renew his license and had to go back to the hiring hall and look for a ship. And once I was invited to go into the hiring hall at the Union Hall in San Francisco, which was a very radical political place. And that what's amazing about these places is nobody's there. Nobody goes there. It's only a very small people in a very special world. Merchant Marine is a pretty good example too. A worldwide phenomenon. Transnational. People of all ages, people of all nationalities, people of all religions engaged in this process that nobody ever sees. To be able to get into that thing, into that world through reading it in your armchair is really, really remarkable, to be able to do it and do it again and do it in a different discipline or a different profession more than once.
Right. I mean, I think how things work and trying to explain the world through people is what John McPhee is about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when we were talking about this earlier, I kept saying, well, how are we going to relate this to the ostensible purpose of this program, the spirit of Maine, evoking the spirit of Maine? And time and time again, I asked myself the question, what in the world does that actually mean? And we're groping for it in little bits and pieces. How would you relate John's work first and then John's persona second to this abstract spirit of Maine?
Well, I'm not really a believer in kind of supernatural things, but in another life, John McPhee could have been a Mainer. I mean, he could have been born and lived in Maine, because he so, I think, embodies kind of many of the values and interests of people in Maine. I think that he's connected with it in many ways, both literally and figuratively, throughout his career. I mean, he's been to Maine many times. But the subjects he's written about, even when they're not about Maine, are about things which are very, I think, close at hand to what Maine is all about.
Shall we talk about some of those, and maybe in the context of some of the books that you have in front of you?
Well, I mean, I think one obvious example is Survival of the Bark Canoe, where this is about a master craftsman in New Hampshire who builds canoes in the fashion of Indians from long ago in the past. But as part of that book, McPhee almost always goes somewhere with people. He doesn't like to interview people across the desk. He wants to get people out and try to see them through some experience. And in this book, he goes on a long outdoor on the river trip with this man in Maine. And they go down rivers in Maine, and he kind of sees his craft of canoes through the, on the job in Maine. So they went on a trip with, I think it was two or three other men, and they went on this long river journey as a way to kind of, for McPhee, it gave him a chance to understand the canoe builder even more, but also to be able to explain his craft kind of as it was at work, as opposed to in his workshop in New Hampshire. And one of the interesting aspects of the book is that it turned out that the creator of the canoes, this master craftsman, didn't behave very well out in the, he behaved in ways which I think, you know, McPhee and others might disapprove of. He wasn't very collaborative. He kind of was ornery. And McPhee wrote about that too, because I think that that's, again, McPhee is in a sense, in a very understated way, I think McPhee is a social commentator. And he did that in this book. And I think it was, again, part of him being sort of in the spirit of Maine. I don't think the people in Maine would want to think that they would act the way this man acted out.
No. Ornery is a proud aspect of the character. No, we do ornery quite well, as a matter of fact. And some people do ornery to extreme, and they are proud of it.
All right, well, then he represented that Maine spirit, the canoe man.
Who are the others? We've talked about Brouwer. We've talked about the canoe builder. Who are some other individuals that are bright in your memory of the work?
Well, there was another Maine person who had the improbable name of John McPhee. So John McPhee in 1984 published a piece in the New Yorker called North of the CP Line, North of the Canadian Pacific Line, Canada Pacific Line. And he wrote about a state of Maine fish and game warden who flew around in planes north of that line. And lo and behold, this man had the name of John McPhee. And he had engaged with the author John McPhee over time, and they met. And then the two McPhees traveled around Maine together. And he learned a lot and told a lot about fish and game in Maine that way.
Talk about a brother from another mother. That's great. You meet your doppelganger.
Right. It's very funny. But apparently the other John McPhee usually went by the name of Jack, even though his name was John.
Amazing. The New Yorker, of course, represents a kind of Maine connection. John McPhee's reputation was built not just around the books, but built around the consistency of his writing published in the New Yorker by, what, at least four editors, maybe five. A kind of consistency of editorial discernment that is unusual. Some writers stay with these magazines, they become institutions. Clearly, John McPhee is a New Yorker institution. How did that work? How did he first get commissioned to write for the New Yorker? Do you know?
So he dreamed of being a writer for the New Yorker from about age 9, which is a kind of unusual dream. It started with a elementary school classmate of his who shared his parents' copy of the New Yorker, and McPhee apparently loved the articles right away. And then it continued the next year when McPhee was 10, but even more improbably, the college football correspondent of the New Yorker came to Princeton to write about the Princeton football team and ended up writing about John McPhee running around on the football field as a 10-year-old. So again, you know, McPhee's father was the physician for the team, and John would go with his father every day to practice, and he would run around. It was a very funny mention. This further connected him to the magazine, having his name in the magazine when he was a 10-year-old. So he, through high school and college, he would write articles for the New Yorker, send them in. They would all get rejected. This continued even after he went to work for Time magazine. He still tried to write for the New Yorker. All his articles were rejected. He said he could have papered many rooms with his rejections from the New Yorker, but he held on to this. So eventually, his big break for the New Yorker, which I think, again, is a story that says a lot about John McPhee, was the Bill Bradley profile that was published in 1965. So finally, there was a little bit of a thaw, and the New Yorker showed a little bit more interest, and they said, well, send us some ideas. John sends, I think, five ideas, and the deputy editor writes back to him and says, well, try any of those, but not the one about the basketball player. We already did that. So 2 years earlier, in I think 1963, the New Yorker had published a profile of Bob Cousy.
Oh, yeah.
And they decided that was all they were going to do about basketball. So McPhee, most people would try one of those four ideas, right? Instead, McPhee responded with a 5,000-word letter back to the man saying why he was going to do Bill Bradley, whether the New Yorker was interested or not. And of course, turned that into really writing part of his article about Bill Bradley. And at that point, the editor at the New Yorker said, well, we'll take a look at it. And they bought the article and he became a staff writer.
So the editor back then must have been, was it Harold Ross?
No, it was William Shawn.
William Shawn.
Yeah. So John McPhee has worked mostly for William Shawn. Yeah. But for the last 25 years, he's worked for David Remnick as the editor of the New Yorker. And Remnick is one of his legion of incredibly distinguished students from Princeton. So that's a kind of interesting
thing. I can see the Remnick collection. I wonder about Tina Brown.
Yeah, it was not, I don't think it was a great marriage. Mm-hmm. And it actually explained why in the Tina Brown years, McPhee wrote some articles for other publications, including The Atlantic, which were subjects that she just wasn't interested in. They were not really simpatico.
So he came to Maine, though. That New Yorker connection brought him to Maine. He knew, obviously, he knew Roger Angel, and he knew E.B. White, I assume.
Yeah, I think he really was much closer to Roger Angel than E.B. White, just the way it worked out timing-wise. And he came up a number of times to visit Roger and Carol in Brooklyn. So beyond even his writing in Maine, he would come to Maine to do things. And again, as an avid fisherman, that was a draw as well.
Was he a freshwater fisherman or a saltwater fisherman?
I think he's been mostly a freshwater person.
What's your favorite book?
I think that's kind of like asking somebody their favorite child. Well, in my case, I only have one child, so there's no choice. But I don't think I have a favorite. I think that in my mind, I think of the classic probably as being Encounters with the Archdruid, because I think that kind of embodies so much of what John McPhee is about. But there's so many just wonderful books that he's done.
What's the most forgotten one?
What's the most forgotten? Well, I don't think Oranges has been forgotten. I don't think any of them been forgotten. His early books, all his books are still in print. That's something he's insisted on. He's been with Farrar Straus for his entire career. And one of the reasons was is they were willing to keep his books in print. So I don't think any of them have been totally forgotten. He really didn't become a bestseller until Coming Into the Country about Alaska, which was his 13th book. So it took a while. And since then, I mean, his sales were much greater. So I don't think anything has been forgotten, since then.
Oranges, I think, was one of the first examples of a genre where you take one thing, a ubiquitous thing, and you write, 70,000 words about it and its history. The one I like also is The Pencil, right. The History of the Pencil.
Right. Well, but the Oranges
kind of book that's a wonderful opportunity to exercise both your sort of research abilities, but also your imagination.
Right. I mean, Oranges is another great McPhee origin story. He came up with the idea to do that book because he was commuting through Penn Station in New York City, and he noticed through the seasons that the oranges that were being used to make orange juice at the stand there were different colors. And that made him curious, and he pitched the idea to William Shawn, who actually right away said, fine. McPhee's pitch about that book was literally to William Shawn, oranges? ? And Shawn said, fine.
Great. What's the most esoteric one, do you think?
I would say, I'm not sure it's among the books. I think that, looking to the material that I found that very few people have read, he has done a series of introductions and forewords and afterwards for other people's books, which have not been widely explored, whether they're about fishing or about photography. So he's written about, he has a whole other body of work. There's a charming piece, which I think not many people have read, was in the 2000s, Princeton University Press republished the Thoreau's Week on the Merrimack and the Concord Rivers. And McPhee wrote a long introduction to that book in the form of a journey that he took with his son-in-law on a canoe or a kayak through where Thoreau went. And it was a very funny piece. For example, he wrote about when the rivers went through a golf course now, and he wondered what the row would have made of people, you know, pounding on the ground with metal clubs. So I think there's a lot of McPhee out there, which not many people have seen.
Yeah, that's amazing. Is he your friend?
Oh, I don't think he's my friend. He's definitely a hero, and he's somebody I respect enormously. I feel incredibly privileged to have been able to be with him and to write about him. So I feel incredibly, a lot of gratitude that he has let me in. So this is from Survival of the Bark Canoe, which was published in 1975 as a book. And I think this, you know, passage gives you some sense of McPhee's writing about Maine and many other places. In 6 hours, we have traveled 5 miles, and the wind, under the noon sun, has risen even more since we stopped. There is something cyclical but unpredictable about the rise and fall of lake winds. They decline in force and decline a little more, and soon the water seems negotiable. So we collect our gear and start to load up. Then, like a siren, the wind goes high. We settle back, watch the lake, the wind subsides. Again, we load the canoes, only to be pushed ashore by a heavy squall. On the same lake where we have been trying to paddle canoes with a loaded weight of several hundred pounds into heavy winds, log drivers a century ago were, by hand, moving booms that weighed many thousands of tons. They fought such winds for days and nights. They could not stop to sleep, or the wind would shove the boom backward, possibly breaking it open against the rocky shore and hopelessly scattering the logs. So McPhee is always trying to, you know, teach and to tell you the history of a place. So not only is he describing the scene now, but he's taking you back and telling you more about how it was and what you might learn.
This is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors, artists, and exemplars who evoke the spirit of Maine. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio 89.9 FM, streaming online and archived at weru.org and available as podcast on pointedfirs.org. I'm your host, Peter Neal. I'm speaking today with Noel Rubinson regarding the extraordinary range of subject and insight of the author and New Yorker writer, John McPhee. We talked earlier and said we would come back to the phrase, the literature of fact, that being the title of his course. And in an email exchange, you mentioned that this was sort of another way of talking about creative nonfiction. And it's a genre now that's sort of exploded in the world to the point where creative nonfiction is probably much more attractive and published as creative fiction. Frankly, the market for creative fiction seems to be lost. Market for fiction ebbs and flows, but this whole debate about creative nonfiction and the role of the writer and relationship with the subject. Have you any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, McPhee really kind of railed against the idea of somebody saying his book read like a novel, because McPhee really valued fact above everything else. Creative nonfiction is a title he's fallen under, but I think the literature of fact is closer to what he feels close to. He's really a no-nonsense kind of writer. You think about some of his contemporaries, people like Tom Wolfe, Joan Didion, Gay Talese. I mean, McPhee's kind of public persona has been much more laid back and not, you know, it's been all about the story, all about the facts.
Not a public intellectual at all.
Well, I think he certainly is an intellectual, but he never went out to parties. He didn't give speeches on causes. He wanted to do the work of telling people's stories.
Mm-hmm. The literature of fact is a very, I like the phrase a lot, actually, because it elevates something that's different than fiction to literature. It's not a secondary genre. Creative nonfiction, it seems to me, a kind of attempt to gloss up, shine up, journalism as to something a little bit more elegant and creative. And it just happens to be true, not imagined. And there's as I think about it, there's a kind of reversal of sensibility there, where imagination and fact, how do you relate those things when you come across them? How do you do that in your own writer's sensibility? So creative nonfiction sounds to me like something that's been, developed by the marketing department. and literature of fact is really straightforward. It's in the canon. It's just the right phrase. Anyway, he may be the first saint. They don't give prizes, do they, for the literature of fact?
Well, he won his Pulitzer Prize. So for his collection of geology books. And even within that, I think there's a great little story about his humility. He was, in 1999, he was teaching one of his seminars at Princeton. And it was a once-a-week seminar, probably two or three hours. And they took a break. And they took their break. They came back, finished the class, and the door opened, and about 30 people rushed in, including reporters. So what happened was that during the break, McPhee had learned that he had won the Pulitzer Prize for Annals of the Former World, his collection of geology books, and he hadn't shared it with the class. He just finished out the class. And the next week, one of the students in the class told me, everybody wanted to know, well, why didn't you tell us? Why did you keep doing the class? He said, well, I respected your time. I wanted to finish out the class. He has incredible respect for other people and their time and their seriousness.
Is it possible that he could be a writer without ego?
Well, he's got ego, because he cares, dramatically about, who reads his work and how it does. But it's not, I think it's kind of it's a healthy ego.
There's always the question of generosity with teachers. Some teachers are really selfish. They impart the information, but it's theirs, and they're sort of sharing it because maybe they're obligated to by contract, or they're willing to overcome their disrespect for the stupid students who can't possibly understand what they know. I think it's the same thing is true with writers who write blurbs for other writers' books. I think that when the measure of generosity in that, when you take the time to read the book, you take the time to explain the book to a student, it's a really wonderful, generous public act by people who tend also to be very inwardly contained and sometimes very antisocial.
Well, I'll give you a really interesting comment on that, on two aspects of that. The first is to point out that John McPhee has never done a book blurb. That goes back to his principles. He just doesn't believe in that. He thinks it's a kind of a corrupt, unnecessary system. But in terms of generosity, I would tell you a story which I think speaks volumes about McPhee, which is that on one occasion, I went to visit his academic office, which at the time was in the turret of Geo Hall at Princeton, which is the geology building, a wonderful coincidence that his office would end up there. And the elevator doesn't go all the way to the top. So here's John McPhee and me. He's 92 years old. We get to where the top of where it goes, and I watch him bound up the stairs to his office. He opens the door, and all I can see are books all around. And so I thought that was not that shocking. But very quickly, I came to realize that all the books I was seeing were books by former students of his who had sent them to him with their inscriptions of thanks for all that he had meant to them. There's hundreds of books in his office. I think he has been obviously the most incredibly generous teacher of his students and to other people he's come in touch with. That's been a really important part of his life. And I think a huge part of his legacy, because now there literally are hundreds of writers who are writing in his spirit around the world, mm-hmm. probably thousands. Mm-hmm.
I just want to point out that there are two blurbs on the back of your book. One by David Remick, by the way, the editor of The New Yorker. So I guess, you know, there are principles and then there are principles.
I also would point out that McPhee is the only author I know in the world, and there may be others, who has never had his photograph on a book jacket.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Because he believes, we've talked about this, he believes he doesn't want to get in between the reader and the story.
Yeah.
And he thinks that not having his picture. So he's a very self-effacing person, but an incredibly generous person.
How have you ever heard him read aloud?
Yes. Well, I've heard many, you know, audio and video tapes, some of which I included links to in the book.
What's it like?
It's, you know, it's the sound of his voice. He's not a dramatic actor. You know, it's not, I don't think you would confuse it with Richard Burton, you know, who's somebody who he profiled. He's reading his words. I think the sound of his words are really important, and that's always been important. I think it's something he took from his father, that the sound of the words was important. And McPhee, in his writing process, reads everything he writes out loud as he's doing it, preferably to somebody else, because he knows that in the process of reading it aloud and also hearing comments, you learn about what works and what doesn't work.
Well, I my heart soars because if I ever talk to a writer, potential writers, I say, look, the one thing you need to do, no matter whether you're an author or you're just giving a talk to the local historical society, whatever it is, read it aloud, hear the sound of the words, because that's what's happening in the brain. The brain is not just seeing hieroglyphs on the page, it's hearing the sounds and the meanings of the word. I couldn't possibly do it every time to somebody in the room. I could do it in a public place, but to do it, you know, reading a draft aloud every time seems terrifying to me.
Well, one of his books, Encounters of the Archdruid, mm-hmm. came just after McPhee had a really terrible divorce in the late 60s, and he was feeling very low, and he got into this rhythm with Robert Bingham, who was his editor at The New Yorker at the time, of reading drafts aloud. And eventually, he had read the entire book of 60,000 words aloud to Bingham. Over the telephone. But, you know, the other place that it came from, besides his father, was his high school English teacher. He had the same high school English teacher, a woman named Olive McKee, for three of his 4 years in high school, which for most people would be pretty boring. But for McPhee, it was great because he loved her. And she had two requirements of her students, that everything they wrote, they had to write a structure out before they wrote it. And everything they finished, they had to read aloud in front of the class, which you can imagine in high school, you know, was pretty hard to do because people would laugh, they would throw things at you, but it put them in good habits.
How has it affected your own writing?
Well, I think I've always thought about structure because of McPhee. And I don't think I pass his test of always writing out a structure before I write something, but I do it more times than I don't. And reading aloud is between, I had a newspaper editor once talk to me about that. So I kind of learned that even before I met and heard this from McPhee. So I try to do it whenever I can. I sometimes will read an email out loud because I think that anything you're doing, I want it to sound right and be right. And reading it aloud, I totally agree with you, helps that process enormously.
I want to go back to the influence of the father. What about the mother?
I think his mother was a proofreader for much of his work, for much of his life. So that was a pretty big influence. I think he told me that there was something that she proofread when she was in her 90s of this. So I think this was a role. I think she was a really main emotional support for him throughout his life. He started to write about her pretty late in life. He didn't really write personally until the last 10 or 15 years. There's a a wonderful essay that he wrote, which is the lead of one of his collections, about a parachute toy that his mother gave to him, which if people haven't read that, it's definitely, you know, very touching to read.
How is so there was a, I don't want to go too deeply into his personal life, but there was a divorce. There was a son.
No sons.
No sons. Four daughters. Three daughters.
Four daughters.
Four daughters. And are there grandchildren?
No, oh, there are many grandchildren.
Yep. You have any sense of his relationship to his grandchildren?
I think very close. He's dedicated his books to his grandchildren, a number of them in recent years. Mm-hmm. He talks about them very close. All his daughters have published books as either writers, translators, or photographers.
Oh, that's amazing. That's wonderful. As a grandfather, I'm now very concerned about the relationship and building a relationship.
He's close. And he remarried in the early 70s and has been married for more than 50 years again.
Mm-hmm. Is he working on a new book?
He is. He's working on a second volume to Tabula Rasa, which was published 2 years ago. It's a collection of short pieces of things which he thought about writing longer pieces about, but never did. So it's kind of a hodgepodge, very charming. And he's also writing about some new things. I mean, for example, he wrote a lovely, funny piece about Wordle, right, his experience with that puzzle. Some of these have been published in The New Yorker in recent years. He tells me he's written enough for the second volume, but I don't think the publication date has been set yet.
What about your next book?
My next book, I'm working on an idea which I'm excited about, which is about a small patch of land at Arlington National Cemetery, which is reserved only for Confederate soldiers. Until recently, there was a Confederate monument there, which actually now they're talking about it was taken down, and they're talking about putting it back up. And I'm looking to tell the history of that burial ground as kind of an example of our forever civil wars. So very.
What a way to look at the social history of the time through something as, you know, a patch of land,
right,
memorializing, a whole lot of people who basically are forgotten. Very interesting. What a exciting opportunity. I envy you that.
Thank you.
Good. So how's the book doing?
I've been having a great time out on tour. I've been on a number of stops around the Northeast. I had a great reading at Blue Hill Library, which is a wonderful library. I was out in Los Angeles. I had a reading there. Have some more coming up in Boston. I've been getting a whole steady stream of wonderful messages from people I've never met, telling me how much they've enjoyed the book. A lot of people, former students of his, people connected with Princeton, connected with Deerfield, writers. It's really been very gratifying.
Well, you've provided an amazing service when you think about it. I mean, you've taken this enormous body of work, 30 or 40 books, thousands of articles, digested them, organized them, guided us to where we can find them, rationalize them in ways, and humanize them in a way by just simple accessibility. I mean, you write a book and for the most part, it's gone very, very quickly these days. And to have someone come and I think essentially catalog and collect and present or contextualize a body of work as grand and large and varied as McPhee's work is a service.
Well, I appreciate that. So he's already, you know, made my book a little outdated because he continues to write and continues to have more collections. I was excited to see that finally the Library of America has committed to doing a volume of his work, which they're going to do his work about Wild America, it's going to be called.
That's great.
Some of the writing about Maine, which is going to come out next spring, in spring of 2026. And not surprisingly, David Remnick is going to be the editor of that book.
Right. The Library of America doesn't necessarily keep books in print forever.
True.
Well, perhaps he'll insist that they do that. And that would be very good for those of us who've done Library of America books and found them discontinued.
Well, McPhee is a fierce advocate for his work, so I expect that he's working on them already.
Oh, great. That's terrific.
So I have one other reading to share. This is from North of the CP Line, which appeared first in the New Yorker in 1984. And I think it just shows his power of description again. And this, again, happens to be in Maine. Spread out radially from most of the fishing shacks were set lines called traps. On most lakes, five lines are permitted per license. Holes are dug with gasoline power augers that can penetrate in moments the 4-foot hide of a lake. A spring-loaded flag is placed at each hole. When a fish gets on the line, the flag goes up and a fisherman comes out of the shack. Wind can trip the spring, sending up what is known as a wind flag, symbol of false hope. One of the many skills of a warden pilot is an ability to taxi a fishing shack without sending up a garden of wind flags. Now, within that one paragraph, there's just an incredible number of facts that it's an incredible description. And he's trying to teach you something about something that, you know, most people probably don't know. There are probably people, you know, among your listeners who knows at least some of these things, but many who know none of them.
I'm struck by the phrase in the middle of it, when the trap trips and the flag drips, a symbol of false hope. That is a great phrase.
That's a great one.
That's a great one. No, this has been terrific. I really appreciate it. We didn't prepare much for this at all. We sort of got to it at the very last minute. And it's been a delightful conversation. It was sweet and easy. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Oh, I thank you very much. It's been very, really an intelligent conversation. And I appreciate all your comments.
Great. Thank you. You have been listening to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. My guest today has been Noel Rubinton, and by association, John McPhee, prolific observer of nature and humans within. We've been discussing the vast range of McPhee's writing, his special perspective, and his quiet association with Mainers and their spirit. My guest next time will be Jane Crozen, writer and cartographer, whose publication of historic Maine maps will be the focus of a discussion of how maps provide a visual context and explanation of local events and human behavior, a landscape of tangible information in which the spirit of Maine can be discovered. This has been Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I am your host, Peter Neal. Thanks for listening.
You've been tuned in to Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a Leeds Island Books audio project. Produced by Trisha Badger. Theme by Casey Neal for Mock Turtle Music. Hosted by Peter Neal. Visit pointedfirs.org for more information. And find us on your favorite podcast app. Thanks for listening.